I neglected this morning at the beginning of my comments to express my appreciation and acknowledge the visitors who were here. And I normally do that, but did not. I had a lot of material to cover and got right into the lesson. I do want to do so, however, at this time. Not only do we have several who have visited with us that were there this morning, have returned this evening, but we have several others who are visiting with us tonight. And we want you to know, first of all, that your presence here this evening is a great encouragement to us. But we also recognize that it's our responsibility as a congregation of God's people, especially the leaders of this congregation, those that are leading in the period of worship, myself, as I seek to share a word with you, to do whatever it is that we can to encourage you. It is my prayer that what has been done up to this point in time as we have come together to worship God has been indeed an encouragement and a blessing. And likewise, that what I have prepared to talk about in the lesson this evening will be likewise beneficial to you. You'll notice up on the board there is an arcade game. I'm dating myself perhaps a little bit here, but this is the Pitfall game that came out on Atari back in 1982. Now, that's just a couple of years after I graduated from high school. And some of you may look at that with its primitive graphics and think, how in the world could anybody have any interest in that? It actually was one of the most successful video games in the history of the genre. 4 million copies were sold by Activision for that Atari game. And somebody says, well, you are a geek if you know all that. Well, I looked it up on Wikipedia today, so I didn't have it at hand, but I did want you to know exactly what it is that you were looking at. And the game was called Pitfall, and the little stick figure that if you use sufficient imagination, you can see is actually swinging a vine over a pond full of alligators. His name was Pitfall Harry. And the purpose of the game was to get him through the entirety of the game, have him be able to get all of the treasures that were to be found by jumping over holes in the ground and quicksand and swinging over pits with alligators and avoiding scorpions to get the gold. That was Pitfall Harry. But the reason why it was apparently such an enjoyable game is the fact that there was some thrill associated with escaping the pitfalls, all the dangers that beset him in his adventure. I came across some material on the internet written by a man by the name of Irvin Lee that was entitled Pitfalls, and had a number of examples of pitfalls that may befall a Christian as he seeks to maneuver his way to heaven. And of course, the graphic that first came to mind being that this is my period of time when I was a young person was Pitfall Harry, and I thought that might be an appropriate way to start our time together. As we look at some of those pitfalls, and I have basically four that I want to make note of in the lesson this evening, I want you to again understand what a pitfall is. Is it described or is it defined? It is an obstacle or a danger that is not necessarily recognized. A pitfall would be something that may be hidden. It may be that an individual who is overcome in some indiscretion or some sin may believe himself to be safe, may believe that he is capable of handling any particular situation or circumstance, but in reality the danger is lurking, the danger is real, and unfortunately too often individuals who are not on guard can be caught. And so I think it is an appropriate thing to consider. The material, again, is not my own, but we could supply with the 4 points that we're making in the lesson this evening. We could remove those and supply 4 others. There are many pitfalls that may beset Christians in their lives, things that may not be immediately evident as dangerous, nevertheless are, things that we need to be on guard against. And the Bible is replete with warnings, replete with instructions as to how to avoid such things. And again, by no means exhaustive, but perhaps representative, we will discuss 4 of those things in the lesson today. First thing we want to make note of is the way the Bible describes what we might refer to as strong drink or alcoholic drink in the Bible. Both Old and New Testament refer to the dangers of strong drink. But what we're referring to here is an intoxicant. I want to make note of that because there are a lot of arguments that are made and attempts to rationalize away the dangers of drinking and social situations or of imbibing to a certain extent or another of alcohol. the Bible warns about the dangers of doing that. Now, not all of the intoxicants that are so readily available in our society today were as available in olden times. It took a great deal of effort to fortify the fermented grape sufficiently in order to cause drunkenness or easily cause intoxication in times past. There are methods that have been used in the fermentation process and other processes to make the strong drink much stronger in our time. In fact, it can be said that all of the, quote, improvements that have taken place, whether it be with regard to the fermentation of wine, the brewing of alcoholic beverages such as beer and other types of strong drink, that the purpose in these improvements is to, in effect, make it more easy to become intoxicated. The improvements are to strengthen the intoxicating effects of those types of drinks. And might I add to that is that there are other types of intoxicants that perhaps were not as familiar to individuals in times past that are nevertheless very prevalent today. And specifically, I would have reference to drugs illicit in nature, or perhaps even licit drugs, that is, legal drugs, that are nevertheless used in illicit ways. And it is these things that we refer to when we talk about pitfalls or dangers. But the Bible, again, makes reference on a number of occasions to the danger of strong drink. One example of that is found in the 20th chapter of the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 20, where the wise man says that wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. And I can tell you that there have been any number of occasions where individuals who on one occasion may have argued with me with regard to the relative safety of engaging in the drinking of such alcoholic beverages, perhaps in a social setting, minimize the dangers of that, who nevertheless, as time progresses, find themselves in a situation to where they have sinned because of such drink. And in fact, you'll note very carefully and clearly that the writer of the Proverbs on this occasion is referring to those who would deceive themselves into thinking that the nature or character of such intoxicants is different than what it is. Understand this. The reason why people drink is to become intoxicated. Now, I understand and realize that some may like the taste. I also understand and realize that there are any number of other beverages that could be imbibed in that are not intoxicants, that are likewise very tasty. The choice that is made to drink strong drink is made because of the effects on the system, because of the intoxicating effects. That's something that the world recognizes. In fact, I don't know of anyone who has ever argued against that reality other than Christians. I sometimes wonder about that. And in fact, some of the things we'll talk about this evening, that is the case. The world recognizes the intoxicating nature of drink. The world recognizes the reason why they want to drink is, quote, to take the edge off, or to put a buzz on, or because it allows them to relax, or it allows them to forget. Sometimes it allows them to become oblivious to the pains and difficulties of life. This is a means of escape. That's why they do it. That's why they enjoy doing it. And that's why they're going to persist in doing it. But then you talk sometimes with Christians who will look at those same things and they will deceive themselves with regard to the nature or character of strong drink. Wine mocks. Strong drink causes one, in effect, to be a brawler or to lose control with regard to his emotions and actions. And individuals who think that it is otherwise, they are deceiving themselves. This is a pitfall. There are some who may be able to convince themselves that it's something that they can do and it will not impact their lives. They are wrong. They are mistaken. Christians ought to have nothing to do with strong drink. I want you to note also, that same book, in the book of Proverbs, in the 23rd chapter, and because of the length of the reading, we will not put it up on the board, but I would like you to follow along if you have a Bible with me in chapter 23. And beginning in verse 29, a description that is given by the wise man concerning that strong drink, and in fact, the individual is described here on this occasion who has engaged in drinking. And I want you to look at it and see whether or not the description that is given is accurate as you consider individuals who have, as is stated here, tarried long at wine. Notice verse 29. He says, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaints, who has wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes. Those who linger at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine. And then he gives his admonition. Do not look upon the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. That's an indication and an observation of the nature of the enticement. The reason why it is so effective is because it looks like something. And by the way, with regard to that, it not only has reference to physical properties. And you'll see a wine connoisseur that will swirl the wine in the cup and look at the color, and he'll sniff the bouquet, and he'll rinse it in his mouth and taste it as he imbibes in the drink. And there is something that is supposedly sophisticated about that, number one. And secondly, it is something that brings a great deal of joy. And there is that enticing nature of it. In addition to that, there is that realization that those who do those things are looked upon as sophisticated often in our culture and society. You look at that, you look at the individuals on the commercials that are going for the gusto and seem to always be having a wonderful time. And you look at that and you say, that's something that I would like to do. That's something that is enjoyable. That those people are having fun and I want a part of that. And the answer of the wise man is, don't look at the wine in that way. But notice instead in verse 31. Don't look upon it that way, but rather in verse 32, at the last, this is the reality, it bites like a serpent. It stings like a viper. Your eyes, this is the reality. Not we're all having fun. Look at how sophisticated we are. The reality is your eyes will see strange things and your heart will utter perverse things. You'll be like the one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like the one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they struck me, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? The picture that he is bringing forth is one that we see similarly in our time, when you have an individual whose interest, when he awakes, perhaps lying in the gutter, or when he awakes devoid of companionship because his wife and his children have left him. When he awakes despite the fact that he does not have a job because he couldn't hold a job because the alcohol has taken hold. And he says, where can I find another drink? And that's the reality of the use of alcohol. It is destructive. And irregardless of degree, and individuals think, well, that happens to other people, but that won't happen to me. The fact remains that individuals who are doing that very thing are not wise. They are deceiving themselves. They are being, as stated in Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1, led astray. Another final passage to consider along these lines is the writing of the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 1 through 3 of the text. And you'll remember that the apostle on this particular occasion is admonishing them with regard to the life that they had lived, and a call for them to turn away from those things that were characteristic of their life before becoming Christians. He refers to it as the way of the Gentiles. But you'll notice in verse 2 of that text, we are told that a person who is a child of God should no longer live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lust of men, but now, he says, for the will of God. Now the contrast is being made by Peter on this occasion. What are the lusts of the flesh? The life that is lived in the flesh is contrasted with those who are seeking the will of God. He said, we in verse 3, we have spent enough of our past lifetime, those things that we did before we became children of God, in doing the will of the Gentiles. We have spent enough of our past walking in lewdness and lusts and drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties and abominable idolatries. And now he calls us, because we are Christians, to put off those things, stay away from those things, no longer engage in those types of activities. Now you'll notice, just very quickly in verse 3, that there are three things in that list that impact our point. First one, drunkenness, which has reference to an excess, a complete excess of drink. Revelries, which would have reference to excess of drink in the midst of carousings. And then drinking parties, which comes from the Greek word potos and is literally translated banquetings, having reference to partying where there is drink or alcohol that is present. Now, we understand drunkenness, we understand revelries, but when it comes to that social drinking, a lot of times brethren don't have that ability to understand that they're going to be led astray if they engage in such activities. If we were to just kind of give a parallel concerning those three categories, the first one would be the drunk who's laying in the gutter in the street. The second would be the keg parties in the frat houses. And the third section or category would have to do with the, quote, office party, you see. Here, individual, this is a time we've been working hard, and now it's Christmas time, and so now is the time we let down our hair a little bit, and we can take the edge off, and we can enjoy ourselves, and of course the alcohol flows freely, and Christians sometimes take part in those things. And the Apostle Peter on this occasion says, we spent enough of our time doing that. That's what the world does. The world, again, does that and revels in it. The world does it, doesn't care. The world does it, recognizes it for what it is, and goes for the gusto, glories in what they're doing. But that ought not to be characteristic of a Christian. We spend enough of our time doing that. Now, in our present life, as contrasted with the past life, we need to stop these things. Lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Another moral point to make with regard to this is that dancing is a pitfall. Someone says, what? What are you talking about, dancing? Well, I'm referencing lasciviousness. And in fact, you'll note in the text of Galatians chapter 5 in verses 19 through 21 that the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envies, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. So here is a long list of things that are considered sinful. They are the lust of the flesh. You'll note in the latter part of verse 21 that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now in that list you find underlined the word lewdness. It is in the King James Version of the text referred to as lasciviousness, and is the Greek word asygia, and it simply has reference to that which is filthy or wanton, having reference to things of a sexual nature. Not having reference to sexual intercourse, that is porneia, and is a different word entirely, but has reference to those things that lead up to that illicit action. Some people say, wait a second, how does that describe dancing? Well, again, it may be that sometimes Christians don't recognize it. That's why we put this as being a pitfall, something that may not be immediately evident. But again, the world does. The world recognizes it very clearly. Remember that the show that's on television, one of those reality shows like American Idol, one of them is called Dancing with the Stars. And it is very common. You have these individuals, some of them male, some of them females, that are not professional dancers, and they pair up with professional dancers in a dancing competition. And so they'll go around the ballroom, and sometimes what they're doing is perhaps a staid and stately waltz, but other times it is something that is much more sensuous. But whenever you hear descriptions that are given of their actions, of their activity and how well they perform, that's the word that you hear time and again. That was sexy. That was sensual. That was hot. And when you see those kinds of individuals, it talks about, so one of them says on occasion, it looked like they were making love on the dance floor. And they wear revealing clothing. And individuals recognize, the world understands that what this is lasciviousness, and again, revels in it. And I don't know, really, I've not talked with many who are in the world, when you talk about dancing, that's not exactly what they are doing it for. In fact, prom night, what's prom night known for? Prom night is known for the dance and then those events which happen after the dance, when you have individuals who are coupling together and engaging in illicit intercourse. The world knows it. The world understands it. There's a movie. Again, this is perhaps about the same time. It came out pretty close to the time in which Pitfall did, as far as the arcade goes. It was called Dirty Dancing. You want to know why the title of the film is Dirty Dancing? It's a reference to the lascivious nature of the dance. And a part of the plot of that movie, you have an innocent young girl who involves herself with a dance instructor who is older. And there is then the mean old preacher dad who doesn't want her to be involving herself with with that man. And in fact, this relationship is something that is glorified by the film. Now, there are some problems, but love triumphs in the end. Did you realize that a part of that plot is somewhat subliminal, but it's there, is that the young lady who is supposed to be 15 or 16 years old on that occasion gets pregnant. And there's a reference to her, a very subliminal or implicit reference to her having an abortion. The world understands what happens in these things. The world rejoices in these things, has no problem with them. Yes, it's lasciviousness. Yes, we enjoy handling one another this way. Yes, we enjoy the lewd and lascivious bodily movements that characterize the modern dance. That's why we're doing it. And I'll tell you something. You get a lot of those worldly people together, and you get them together dancing with one another, men dancing with other men's wives, and the music comes to a stop. If they continue holding another man's wife in that same way and acting in that way without the music, they'll probably get shot, because the world knows exactly what it is. Rather, what we have to understand sometimes, Christians, young people especially, young ladies especially, don't recognize the dangers of such lasciviousness and lewdness. And you need to understand that anytime you put yourself out there as a sexual individual desiring to entice the lust of another, that is lasciviousness and that is sin. The mechanism of sin is defined in James chapter 1 and verses 14 and 15 by the writer when he says that each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. You notice the nature of lust. An individual is drawn away by his own desires. When that object is there, those desires are inflamed. We're told that when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Anything that is lascivious. People say, why in the world do you, Church of Christers, or Campbellites, or why do you people say that you ought not to swim? Do you have something against water? My answer is absolutely not. My parents live on the water. We own a boat. There's absolutely nothing wrong with swimming. But why do you say that mixed swimming is something you ought not to do? It has nothing to do with getting wet. It has nothing to do with playing in the water. It has to do with the immoral and immodest clothing that is worn that incites lust. And of course, the world sees it. The world glories in it. The world revels in it. That's in fact why the world is involved in those things. But then sometimes we as Christians cannot see it. There's survey after survey after survey that you can go and you can ask men, why is it that you go to the beach? Well, men say is, I go to the beach to see the women. You ask, well, why do the women go to the beach? Women say, majority, I go to the beach to be seen by men. That's the lasciviousness of which we speak. The world knows it. The world recognizes it. The world revels in it. And yet sometimes Christians are overtaken in these things because they're pitfalls. They seek to rationalize the dangers away. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, the Apostle Paul said, beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain. There's the word abstinence. Not to try to minimize it. Not to go just a little ways. Not to curry the favor of the world, but find some line there and get close to the cliff and not go over. No, abstain. Stay away from. Hold oneself off of the fleshly lusts which war against the soul. And they are pitfalls that have led to the destruction of many. A third, and this is not moral per se, but it has reference to being involved with those who are engaged in ungodliness, or they themselves are ungodly and evil people. And we'll say again that evil companionship is, again, a pitfall. I want to remind you of Samson. Samson was an amazing judge of Israel. Perhaps the most powerful man who has ever lived. The ability that he had in warfare was something that was absolutely astounding. And yet he was brought low by a Philistine woman by the name of Delilah. Women were his problem. In fact, in Judges chapter 16, previous to verses 4 and 5, it mentioned that he had gone into a harlot. And then we are told in verse 4 of Judges chapter 16 that afterward it happened that he loved a woman. He loved a woman. But what woman did he love? She was a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. She was a Philistine. And she was not a woman that was true to Samson. She was not one of those women that would exalt the man. Not one of those women who would live as a wife to a man and seek as a wife to encourage the man to godliness and to righteousness in his life. No, not the life. She is well known in history as being duplicitous, as being treasonous and traitorous to Samson. And very early on in their relationship, we are told in verse 5 that the lords of the Philistines, she being a Philistine woman, came up to her and said to her, entice him. Entice him. There's the pitfall of the immoral woman, the pitfall of the seductress, the pitfall of those who are ungodly. And how many times have the ungodly said to you, come and go with us? Why? Why should I go with you? Because if you come with us, we're going to have fun. We're going to enjoy ourselves. It's not that big a deal. They may even say you don't have to do everything that we're doing. Just come along with us. And that was the siren call of Delilah. And he called him to come along with her. Called him to make known the nature and the origin of his strength. And then she betrayed him. And she indeed destroyed him. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, that warning is given to us again. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Do you notice the statement? Do not be deceived. This is what we're talking about. It's a pitfall. Again, the world recognizes it. They run to dissipation. They are doing whatever it is that they can do to enjoy themselves in worldly ways. They don't care about authorities. They speak evil of dignitaries. They engage in all types of activities that are duplicitous, that are depraved, that are ungodly, and rejoice in that. And they say, come with us. And Christians can't see the danger. Young Christians understand and recognize the dangers that are present in this, and understand that if you curry the favor of the ungodly, that you will be corrupted by them. As children of God, we're to be lights in the midst of an ungodly world. Salt that is able to influence the ungodly. But if we allow ourselves to be companions to those who are immoral and to involve ourselves in their activities, then they will corrupt us. You see, Jesus indeed went and he drank and he ate with sinners. It was his intention to come and to save the sinner. But he didn't go with the sinner in his sin. He didn't go with the sinner to his place of sin, to engage in sinful activities, or to stand idly by while others do and allow himself to be corrupted by their influence and their thinking. No, he influenced them. Well, we must understand that we are in the world, but we are not of the world. And understand that evil associations, evil company, evil companions corrupt good habits. You look at that text. And again, the statement, do not be deceived. And you'll note, I also have on the board a few phrases from Romans, the first chapter. You'll remember that the Apostle Paul, in his epistle to the Romans, was talking about the pagan practices of that day and how ungodly they were. Homosexuality and other types of immorality are mentioned specifically in the list that is given on that occasion. But he said the reason why they are engaging in such ungodly activities is because they had become deluded. They had deceived themselves. And in fact, it was a willing self-delusion. In verses 21 through 32, there are several phrases that are used. Look at them. They became futile in their thoughts, and their hearts were darkened. They became fools. And as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things that were not fitting. But in all three of these cases, they became futile in their thought. They became fools. They did not like to retain God in their knowledge. This is the decision that they made. Understand this. If you are deceived, it's not because you cannot know. It's not because you cannot become aware of the pitfall. It's simply that you are not interested in knowing. It's a willful thing. It certainly was the case with the pagans in Romans chapter 1. It is the case with any Christian who thinks that they can be with the worldly, engage in ungodly activities, and maintain their integrity and righteousness before God, because the truth is that they will become corrupted, as indicated by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. And then the final point that I want to make concerning pitfalls, things that are not easily recognized, is fault finding. Now, we're not talking about just judgment. We're not talking about the desire to correct a person who is in sin to the salvation of his soul. But this is where the danger lies, because sometimes individuals can think that because I'm striving to live a life of righteousness and I see sin or what I perceive to be sin in the lives of others, that I have the right to talk with them. And in fact, what they are in actuality doing is becoming fault finders. And there are dangers, criticizers, those who are fomenting strife, and that is a danger as well. We need to be careful. And in fact, in Matthew chapter 7, we find perhaps the most quoted and most oft misquoted passage in the entirety of Scripture. I mentioned that, I think, a week or two ago. It used to be John 3:16 was the one that everybody quoted all the time. But now it's Matthew chapter 7, because as they engage in their activities, and you say, wait a second, that's not right. Judge not, lest you be judged. As if judging in and of itself is something that is unacceptable. But that's not what the text is teaching. The text very clearly establishes that we indeed must judge from time to time. We are to use righteous judgment. But that's the point. The individuals who are described in Matthew chapter 7 were not being righteous in their judgment. Notice what they were doing. He said, judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. That is indicating that if you have a standard that you are using in judging others, you understand this, the standard that you use will be used to judge you as well. And so individuals who go along and they say, look, you've got a splinter in your eye. When you yourself have a plank in your own eye, you don't have the right to say to that individual, you have a splinter in your eye or a speck in your eye when you have a plank or a beam in your home. Rather, what you need to do is first get your life right so that you can in righteousness and in justice say, not that I'm better than you, but rather in righteousness and justice say, I am concerned about you and you need to change. It's a far cry. It's a big difference between that kind of judgment and what we're talking about with regard to fault finding and being critical. What I'm talking about, and the emphasis is to be found in Galatians chapter 5, is the practice that was present among the Christians on any number of occasions. I think the Church of Corinth would be a good example of this. When they were disregarding the law of love, or concerned with their neighbor, or concerned with their brother or their sister, this was one of those situations to where they indeed were arrogant and prideful, and they were picking and criticizing others. It wasn't a concern for the welfare of the soul of an individual that caused them to do this. They just enjoyed the fact that they were better than someone else. They were like a Pharisee who prayed to God and said, God, I am thankful that I'm not like other men, like this publican here. I tithe and I do all of these other things. I'm self-justified, and such an attitude is something that is completely and totally inappropriate for those who are children of God. And so he said concerning individuals who had that attitude, if you bite and you devour one another, beware, lest you be consumed by one another. Again, we're not saying that when an individual is in sin, it is inappropriate to point out that sin. But understand, when we do that, it is because we are aware of what sin does. Separates God from man, and our desire is for them to be reconciled. It's not because we feel ourselves to be better. It's not because we seek to humiliate any man. In fact, any criticism that is devoid of love, where love is not present, is completely and totally inappropriate. And we need to be careful, because if we are those types, then we can fall into the pitfall of devouring and consuming each other rather than practicing the love that God requires. And so, those are four examples. Again, by no means exhaustive, and they may be replaced with other pitfalls, and perhaps we'll have other lessons where we will emphasize those things, but they are certainly represented. And we recognize from those things that there are dangers. Dangers that are present, that may befall us as children of God. And so we emphasize that in order for us to maintain our safety before God, to avoid those pitfalls, we have to be alert. We have to be on our guard. We have to see the pond with the alligators coming so that we'll be able to avoid it. Because the dangers are there. The Apostle Paul says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but walk wisely, walk with wisdom. We must all understand that the devil indeed has snares and traps. He intends to hide them. He needs to make them palatable. That's what we do with a mousetrap, isn't it? This old contraption that has a spring and wood, there's absolutely nothing about that that would be of any interest to a mouse unless you put square cheese on it or a little dollop of peanut butter. And then it becomes enticing. The danger is still there, but it's been camouflaged just a little bit. Not a great deal. Mice are dumb. You don't have to make it look fancy. You just have to put that enticement there. And I'm afraid from time to time that we are a little bit dumb ourselves. Not using the intelligence. We see the enticement, and it is so overwhelming and so alluring that we don't see everything surrounding it. That's why it says, don't look in the cup when the wine is swirling there, when it sparkles and it looks so pretty. Because recognize this, and you can see it. You see it every single day in destroyed lives. You see it every single day in ruin. That it bites like a serpent. That's the true end of those who are caught in the pitfalls that the devil will present before them. We as Christians can be sober, we can maintain vigilance, and if we're diligent in that, indeed we can, in the end, be found faithful and avoid the pitfalls that the devil would place before us. Hope and pray that what we've talked about tonight has been beneficial to you. I want you to consider it very carefully. Maybe that there are some who are here in need of responding to the invitation call. If you're not a child of God, we would invite you to embrace the gospel of our Lord, repent of your sins, confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and be baptized for the remission of your sins, as did the Jews on the day of Pentecost, as did Saul of Tarsus, as did the eunuch, as did Lydia and her household that we studied this morning. If you're willing to do that, then you can become a child of God, as did they. If there is something else that is amiss in your life and you want to make amends at this time, we offer ourselves to you as well. We can assist you in any way to answer that call. We offer an opportunity. Would you come? While together we stand, while we sing.